Welcome to The Point. I'm Steve Junker. Today is our Reporter's Notebook. We're going to speak with WCAI reporters about covering the Cape, the South Coast, and the islands. We're going to take you behind the scenes a bit to talk about how we decide what to cover and what goes into making a radio news feature. And we want to hear from you. What news stories have you heard that stayed with you or changed the way you thought about an issue? What news stories do you think we're missing here at WCAI? What should we be covering more? Is it a place that we're not getting to enough? Is it an issue that's important to you? Give us a call. Join the conversation. The number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send us an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. A little later in the hour, we're going to be speaking with WCAI environmental reporter Eve Zukoff. But we get going right now with WCAI's general assignment reporter, Sarah Mises-Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve. Good to be here.
Sarah, I want to start with a story of yours that we recently aired. It's about the uptick in English language learners in public schools, and it's actually a two-part story. Tell us a little bit about this. Set it up for us.
Sure. So this was a two-part series about the rise in English language learners in schools across the Cape, particularly at Barnstable High School in Hyannis. Our series focused most directly on the dramatic rise in the Brazilian high school student population that the school was seeing an influx of in the past few years, and we spent the first part of the series explaining a bit about the shifting school demographics on the Cape in general, and we looked at how Barnstable was coping with this particularly dramatic rise. And our second part took us into the school and showed us that newly formed community.
So a big part of reporting, obviously, is identifying a story. And this one we heard about the rising number of English language learners on the Cape and in the region. We knew it was an important issue that we wanted to cover, but really that's only the beginning for a reporter and an editor. So much of this is about picking a path into a story or through a story. Now, you ended up at Barnstable High School as a way to focus on this issue, but it was happening not only at this school, this rise in English language learners. Walk us through some of the thinking on this, the process of how this happens.
Sure, yeah. And so you're absolutely right. We had heard there was a general uptick in English language learners across Massachusetts in the past 5 years or so. And of course, the Cape is no exception. But when I called around, I felt like a lot of schools weren't seeing anything that was particularly different from the rest of the state, nor was it as dramatic as, say, what was happening with English language learners in the Boston region or something like that. Many of the schools and the school administrators that I spoke with kind of said as much, that they knew that they were seeing a rise, but they also knew that it was much more dramatic elsewhere. And so, you know, they were kind of following the lead of Boston area schools. But I think Barnstable High School in particular stood out to me. I spoke with their English language coordinator, Kathy Estraukas, and the story really emerged as more than just a story about numbers when I spoke with her. Kathy just really jumped out to me as a character. She talked to me on the phone like she'd been waiting forever to talk to someone about all the work that Barnstable was doing. And she was just so passionate in it, in trying new and innovative things, that it was really hard not to listen. You know, I think a lot of radio reporting, especially for feature stories like this one, comes not just from ideas that I hear out in the field or numbers that I get from school administrators, but from actual people jumping out as good characters with interesting stories and from people who are able to articulate problems or ideas really well. And that was the case with Kathy. That's why we kind of honed in there.
So you spoke with Kathy Estraukas, the school's director of English as a second language. And one of the things she did tell you in the story that was so interesting was that teaching a second language to students is really different depending on their ages.
Yes, definitely. One of the main draws of Barnstable's particular population is that they seem to have this unique issue that was different from what other schools on the Cape were seeing. Yes, it was a rise in their English language learning population, but they were seeing it in an influx of Brazilian teens coming into the high school. Here's Kathy Estraukas.
The little kids will sing songs and do chants and dance around the room and do all the things that help kids engage in language learning. Teenagers are very different in that way. You got to close the door. We don't want anybody to see or hear in the hallway.
And so being someone myself who's only monolingual, but who has tried with very little success to learn a new language in my adult life, I really felt like I sympathized with these students on this. You can see so clearly when you visit the classroom just the culture difference between the newly arrived 16 or 17-year-olds and their American peers. I visited a lot of younger classrooms with English language learners out at different schools across the Cape, where the students, if they're 5 or 6 or 7, they just picked up the language seamlessly. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, they just seemed like normal kids. But I can't imagine if you've grown up in one culture and then you're transplanted into another and you have to learn the language all while navigating all those other typical high school issues.
Right. Well, you think about being a teenager and what the challenges are just inherently in being at that age and then coming into a different culture where you don't know the language and you're plunked down into a school, say, in Barnstable and trying to adapt to that whole shift in culture and climate. Tell me, what's it like going into an environment like a school as a reporter? Do the kids stiffen up when you walk in with your microphone, or the teachers when they know there's, you know, a reporter there with a microphone trying to capture some of the scene of what's happening?
Ooh, all right. So I absolutely love going into schools. I think you at the station know this in particular. And high schools especially are a lot of fun. As some people may know, I come from a background of being an education reporter. And so in a lot of ways, I feel most at home reporting in the school system. Students can just be so honest and upfront with you, and most of them just won't hesitate at all to tell it like it is. I think definitely there are some kids who are afraid of the mic, just like adults. But most of the students who see me come in with the furry dead cat and the headphones, they absolutely love it.
Stop for just a second, because you mentioned the furry dead cat. That people listening to radio to this program, they might not know what a furry dead cat is and why you're carrying one into a high school.
Sure. Yeah. So furry dead cat is actually just the name for our specific microphone, a shotgun microphone, and it's got a little wind guard on it that's kind of furry. So
it's got this wind guard around the microphone, and it's completely covered in fur. It looks like almost a creature that you're carrying in, and that's to cut down on noise, extraneous noise from wind and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. So you come into the classroom with it, and it's kind of actually hilarious looking. And so I think a lot of people really warm to that microphone in particular pretty easily, because it doesn't look very scary, and most high school kids actually kind of want to be on their own reality TV show, I think, for the most part. A lot of them kind of, when I come in, they act like they're auditioning for a talent show or something. I had people like singing and rapping into the microphone, which is really funny, or people asking why I wasn't talking to them. So definitely some enthusiasm. I think the teachers, on the other hand, definitely a little less comfortable. Mm-hmm. I had a couple teachers ask me to not include their voice at all on the tape, which is totally fine. I think most people just want to hear from the kids. And, you know, actually, I had some really sweet moments in particular reporting this story, where it's just kind of like students can be so confronting and honest. I had two of the Brazilian students just turn to me at one point and ask me, what is it like to go to college? And it just took me totally off guard. Because, you know, when you talk to adults, I think they talk to me as if I'm someone carrying the microphone and not necessarily a person. And it kind of just like... I wasn't expecting it. They treated me, or they talked to me like I was just another person, which is obviously true. And they talked to me as if the microphone wasn't there. And I was just like, oh, I can tell you. And I totally see how you might be someone who maybe just doesn't know a lot about the American college system. And you really, it was this little window into their dreams and hopes and all that, which was nice to see.
Now, one of the things that radio can do so well is bring us into a place that we don't ordinarily get to go as listeners. And the high school is an example of that here. I don't know when the last time many of us actually got to wander through a high school while the school was in session. Often when you and I are talking about a story that we want to cover here at the station, one of the first things we talk about is scene. And you have some great sounds of the high school that bring us right into this scene. Explain a little bit about the scene here. And when you're thinking about sound, how it is that we want to put sound at the center of a story and why?
Yeah, I think radio in particular is this great medium to really bring the listener into a place with you and really show them the story almost firsthand on the ground. And so having that scene there is really important to make them feel like they're there with you. And I think for this one, I felt like in order for a listener to really understand what it meant to be new at Barnstable High School, obviously we had to follow one of those students who was emblematic of that new population. And I think the school kind of had, they had selected one particular girl for me, and I wasn't sure if she would work or not, but I actually think that she was so earnest and she's kind of shy and she's very honest, and I think those three things really make her shine as that central character.
We have a clip right here.
My parents are in Brazil, so it was hard. Everything's different. New culture, new people, new school, new everything. It's a new life, right?
Both Braga's parents had worked temporarily on the Cape, and she was actually born in Hyannis. But the family returned to Brazil when she was 6 months old. Then, when she was 15, her parents decided she should immigrate here, since she already had U.S. citizenship and could live with her aunt.
You can have more opportunities. Here's a country of opportunities. So you can have. In Brazil, it's hard to have. You work, work, work. Brazil is a good country. I love Brazil so much. But here you can have a life, you know.
And that's senior Maria Braga at Barnstable High School. There's so much explaining that we can do, but when you put somebody's voice on the radio, it wipes so much of that away, makes it unnecessary. Because to hear her speaking that way, as you say, she's earnest and she's shy, and you can feel so much of the power of the journey that she's on right now.
Yeah, I think it was so important that they gave me someone actually who was a little bit afraid of the mic, I would say, at the very beginning. She definitely had some friends who were way more excited to be on the mic than her. But I thought it was really important because she was she's a little reserved and she's very serious. And she's someone who isn't going to gloss over a lot of the struggles that she's felt, which I thought was important.
We are talking with Sarah Mises-Tan. It's our reporter's notebook. We're talking about covering news and issues across the Cape, the South Coast, and the islands. We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. What news stories do you think we're missing here at WCAI? What should we be covering more? What have you heard that stayed with you? Sarah, I want to talk a little bit about your coverage of sober houses, and this is going back to last year, 2019. Let's just play a clip, and then we can talk about what it meant to cover this story.
Back in 2016, after a string of overdoses at sober houses, a nonprofit called the Massachusetts Alliance for Sober Housing created a certification process. But certification is optional, and estimates are that in Falmouth, only a quarter of sober houses are actually certified. Richard Winant is part of the board of directors. He points out that there's a balance to strike between over-regulating and under-regulating.
What would happen if you, I don't want to say over-regulate, but that's the best way to describe it, a lot of those houses would shut down, the certified ones.
He says many are worried that more formal regulations will mean having to bring all sober houses up to public building code, which would include putting in things like handicap ramps and sprinkler systems.
You're talking $40,000, $50,000 expenditure. They would shut down.
With the state's current opioid crisis, beds at any sober house, even an unregulated one, are in short supply.
Taking a look at sober houses, we both felt like this was such an important story to do for a number of reasons. And tell me your thinking about this when we first started talking about it.
Yeah, so I think this was a story that we'd been wanting to report pretty much since I arrived in early 2018 in the newsroom, and I just didn't have the community knowledge until 2019 to make it happen. Everyone in the newsroom pretty much had their own individual story about this particular issue in the community, living nearby a sober house or suspecting that they were nearby a sober house. And undocumented sober homes were just this kind of, it was part of the feeling of living in Falmouth, I think, that you knew they were around, but you weren't quite sure what they were.
So much of reporting is an education process for everyone here at the station. As you went into this story, we found out about Falmouth having this high incidence of sober homes compared to any other community across the state and why that is. It's because we have rehab services here, particularly through Gosnold. And then we started to unpack this a little bit, and there were so many issues that we wanted to touch on. It grew into a three-part series, and we wanted to talk about what it means to have a sober home in your community for neighbors. What does it mean for people, residents? I mean, this is a key element in trying to tackle the opioid crisis, is going into a sober home. And then some of these homes are, there's only a voluntary regulatory oversight. Is that right? And so the question was, how does that impact the services that people receive? And so we wanted to hear from somebody who had actually been through a number of different sober homes. And you found us somebody to do that. I feel like that voice from within the sober home was one of the strongest elements of this story for me.
Yeah, I think the way we started reporting was essentially just to figure out where we could get more information about sober homes. Turns out it was somewhat tricky to find just like an initial place to figure out, like, okay, what qualifies as a sober home, and is there a regulating agency? And the answer to both of those questions is no, as we found out, or I guess there is no strict regulation on what qualifies a sober home. And of course, there is no regulating agency. But we did find, I believe we just heard a clip from Richard Winant, kind of an unofficial consortium of people who were keeping track of certified sober homes. And I just looked through that list and kind of looked at what was happening in the Boston area. How many were listed on Boston area as Boston area sober houses, and then how many were listed as Falmouth sober houses. And I was really surprised to see that the numbers were really similar. And that was the first red flag to me that, oh, Falmouth has a really high number of these houses per capita, given that we're so much smaller than, say, you know, we're looking at Somerville or something like that.
I think about some of the, when we're putting together a news story like this, we're often trying to go over the voices that we have and what we're missing. And part of this story was going to the police and getting police records to find out how many times they've responded to sober homes over the last few years so that we could communicate that aspect of it. Then also, you know, talking to people at Gosnold about the importance of sober homes in the process of tackling addiction. You have to put together all the different voices to make this kind of story happen.
Yeah, and this was definitely a story where we wanted to make sure the numbers we had were somewhat correct. So we actually did
kind of correct as possible, but a lot of times there aren't the hard numbers that we want as reporters don't specifically exist. So when you say as correct, you know, somewhat correct, it's because we want them as correct as possible, but
Yeah. And so we did ask the police department for their records of all the calls that they've had to sober houses. And they gave us that list. And I actually went through and manually counted off their PDF of however many sober homes there were. And we just saw like how often these calls were coming in. And we actually saw, I think the nice thing about being a reporter is that you can take that like bird's eye view of things rather than getting too politicized. I know a lot of neighbors will feel like one call on a block from a sober house is one too many. But when you actually look at the data, it looked like police weren't actually being called out to sober homes that much in the past couple of years.
The numbers were actually dropping when we looked at the data, which was an important part of the story to report.
Exactly. Yeah. We can kind of be a little bipartisan, I guess, and it's important to not fall on one side too hard or the other. So we did try to get a lot of
a story like this is so complex because there's so many different people with a stake in the story, whether it's the sober house owners or the people running the rehab services or the people in rehab or the neighbors in the community or the police responding. And you're trying to bring all these different voices into the story. You're listening to The Point. I'm Steve Junker speaking with WCAI reporter Sarah Mises-Tan. We're going to the break now. We'll have more in a moment. You're listening to The Point. I'm Steve Junker with WCAI reporter Sarah Mises-Tan. It is our reporter's notebook today. We're talking about covering news and issues across the Cape, the South Coast, and the islands. We want to hear from you. What news stories have you heard that stayed with you or changed the way you thought about an issue? What news stories do you think we're missing here at WCAI? What should we be covering more? Give us a call. Join the conversation. The number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626, or send us an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. A little later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Eve Zukoff, our environmental reporter. Sarah Mises-Tan, we have some news to share with listeners now. The news is that you are going to be leaving us. You've taken a job at a big station in California, which is where you came from when you took this job almost 2 years ago. We're going to miss you.
Yeah, it's really going to be a bittersweet kind of situation. I think I really loved working at the station so, so much. It kind of feels like a family. And I guess I've said this to a number of people, but it's always going to be my home station since I see it as a place where I first got my start as a radio reporter. And it is always going to have that place in my heart. But I will be heading to Sacramento in a few weeks to start a job as their general assignment reporter at the public radio station out there. I'll be reporting on some kinds of different topics. I guess here I was kind of I was environment focused, and I did look at some diversity and race issues on the Cape. In Sacramento, I think I'm going to be more city politics focused and policy focused since it is the capital of the state. But of course, I still plan to tell stories about the community and elevate voices that aren't often heard, no matter where I am. And I think that's always going to be my mission as a reporter.
For folks who don't know, you have a history in print journalism. You were at the Times-Picayune.
Yeah, I've kind of bounced around the entire country. Yes, I was a print reporter at the Times-Picayune. I covered education in New Orleans. And then I was out as a freelance radio reporter out in the Bay Area of California. And now...
And then we pulled you across the country here for a couple of years, and now you're heading back to California.
Yeah.
Looking back on your 2 years here, you really have covered a range of stories.
Yeah, it's been so exciting. I feel like you guys have really just like, because I was the only reporter for a little bit in my time here before we had Eve come in, you guys just kind of gave me a very long leash and said, go report on whatever it is that you feel like is important and bring back a story. Let's talk about it. And
well, a big part for people who don't know behind the scenes, a big part of a reporter's job is to pitch stories. So we say, what stories should we be covering? And everyone in the newsroom is kind of pitching stories like, maybe we do a story about this or about that. And to have somebody come in fresh from the outside, as you did, with, you know, eyes that are open to everything that seems new to you. And to us, we're kind of like, oh, yes, that is something interesting. So it was great to have your energy come in that way and really energize the newsroom as you went out to pursue these stories. I want to talk about a series of stories that you did early on that represented a really nice piece of investigative reporting. And this was a 3-part report on students who come to the region on J-1 visas. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, so this was one of my first big feature stories, was that 3-parter that I pitched while I was still pretty fresh on the beat. And like you said, I think being new to the area was really, really integral in me being able to see this story. I'd never been to Cape Cod before I took this job. That summer was my very first Cape Cod summer. And I was really struck by that influx in young, diverse people who were working service industry jobs. You could see them everywhere. They were serving you sandwiches, bagging your groceries. And most people accepted it as a regular happening if you were a local or if you were a regular summer visitor. But I'd never seen a place that this had happened in such a dramatic way before. So I started digging deeper. I was like, weird. How strange that someone who's from Russia is now bagging my groceries.
It is a different, it's something that's so much a part of our summer environment here. And we're going to talk about this a little bit more. But first, we're going to speak with Eileen, who's calling from Chatham. Good morning, Eileen.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning to your hyper-enthusiastic, valuable reporters. Sarah always brings it up a bit, you know, with her energy, and that's great.
It is great, especially on a Monday morning. It's kind of gray.
Oh, I'll say. Listen, just the topics this morning were just sort of thought-provoking, that to have a chance to just throw something out that is of interest to many and not just myself. And being a resident, well, not a full-time, but as often as we can get there, of Chatham, erosion is just, on our beaches, is just terrible. I mean, it's just constant. And I think the whole Cape's approach to it has sort of been, not to be facetious, but a little bit of a whack-a-mole project. You know, oh, well, there's some erosion there. We better take care of that. We better discuss the budget. We better do all these things, you know. And I discovered, I was under the misimpression that there was a federal or a state policy on beach replenishment. I thought there was a federal standard on that, but there isn't. And, you know, we're not going to start attacking problems at that level. But I'm curious to know what your thoughts, what your reporters, how often that comes up when they're covering meetings, town meetings and such. My guess is it probably doesn't show up until, you know, spring, when people start thinking of the beaches, or when we have these terrible storms. And I think there needs to be some type of unified policy, so one town doesn't say, well, they got money to do their beach and we didn't get ours. You know, it causes a lot of dissent.
Eileen, is there a beach that you go to that particularly seems to be experiencing this?
Yeah, well, I'm part of a little chain, I guess I'd say, between the very end of Harwich and South Chatham. And I think it's Forest Beach. I'm part of and Red River there. I'm part of Cockle Cove, which, of course, us and Ridgevale and Harding's really gets hit. And, you know, it's a combination of level of interest between those that are, say, property owners or those that are property owners that are just near the beach, or income or investment property owners who don't want to lose revenue because people don't want to come to a beach that isn't there anymore.
Okay, Eileen, I'm going to, I just want to give you, tell you that, yeah, it's a lot. And here at the station, erosion and the impacts of the environment on the changing Cape right now are one of our major priorities. And that's a little bit later in the program, we're going to have Eve Zuckoff here, our environmental reporter, who specifically covers a lot of those issues. And as you say, it's really the intersection of there's regulation that's really intense around the coastlines. There's the environmental impact that's changing right now as we're seeing the increasing impacts of storms and erosion and sea level rise. And then there's the fact that a lot of the beachfront property is, you know, abuts private property. And then there's across the Cape, we have all these different towns, and each one has their own approach to this, which makes tackling these kinds of problems so fascinating as we try to discuss them on the radio. And then there's the money. Who pays for all of this? And so,
well, that's it.
So this is one of those stories. Thank you for your call. And we're going to add this to our list of stories that we want to continue to look at and unpack.
Let me thank Tim Wood for his outstanding coverage of Chatham and Harwich in that area. I didn't want to leave this feeling like, well, gee, I think we give it a lot of attention, because he does.
That's great.
And I just want to.
We have Tim on the Friday News Roundup each week. He's a great contributor.
I listen every Friday.
Thanks a lot, Eileen. Thanks for calling
this
morning.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Environmental issues, just, you know, we have here at the station, we have a general assignment reporter, which is Sarah Mises-Tan, who covers just the gamut of everything from you went out to cover a whale necropsy at one point, and you've covered, you know, the chow mein sandwich in Fall River, and you've covered issues of diversity and race across the region. And then we have one other reporter who's a full-time dedicated environmental reporter, and that's an indication of how important environmental stories are to this station. If you have a story that you think we should be covering, give us a call at 866-999-4626. I'm Steve Junker, speaking with Sarah Mises-Tan. Sarah, we were talking about a story that you did about J1 workers on the Cape and how they were coming to the region essentially under visas as student. It was a cultural exchange visa, but once they got here, they were really being put to work doing two or three, or they were kind of here to do work is what they were here to do, which suggested that this was a labor program in some regard, because they were often working two or three jobs.
Yeah, definitely. So this was definitely something where I think being new to the area really helped me see something that other people might have seen as just normal and regular. And for me, it seemed unusual and strange. You know, I had asked some of the students, oh, like, what are you here for? And they said, oh, I'm here to learn about American culture and here to learn English better and things like that. And then I wondered, well, are you really doing that if you're just in Stop and Shop all the time? It's kind of a question that came to the front of my mind. And yeah, you know, it is actually a cultural exchange program at its very definition. Here's Meredith Stewart, an attorney at the Southern Poverty Law Center.
The sponsors have a business relationship with the employers. They need the employers in order to place J-1 students when they get here. And the more employers they have, the more spots they have, the more J-1 students they can take on and the more money they receive from recruitment fees. So there's just really no scenario where a U.S. sponsor is going to hold a bad apple employer accountable.
In the end, she thinks if the program is being used so heavily as a source of labor, it should be regulated by the Department of Labor and billed as such, and not categorized under the Department of State as a cultural exchange.
You know, the fact that the program is masquerading as a tool of diplomatic relations, but is only really functioning in practice as a labor program, I think is emblematic of the issues with its structure and the regulations that fail to uphold the program's original mission.
That is Sarah Mises-Tan's a little piece of your report on J-1 workers across the region. And this turned into a three-part report because, just like so many of these stories, there was so much to unpack. And one of the things that you did, I felt, was so strong about the story is that you really focused in the beginning parts, we focus in on the policy that's led to this issue. At the third part, by the third part, you're really tracking the students themselves who are here and what it means to come to this part of the world and work two or three jobs. And really, your whole experience, like you say, could be kind of the back of the store somewhere, and that's your experience of America for much of this time. And then you went to a – tell us a little bit about some of the events you went. You went to a dinner with the kids. You actually went to a late-night bus ride with these kids.
Yeah, so I think this story actually originated as a story just about that late-night bus route that was supposed to be part of their bike safety program. A lot of J-1 students get hit as they bike along the highways. And so we were kind of – it initially was going to be a quirky story about a bus that – delivered J-1 students back to their homes at night. But I quickly realized that it was something much deeper. I went to the dinner where a lot of people, I think there were some sponsor representatives there who very insistently told me that this was normal and fine. But then, of course, I spoke with the J-1 students there, and they all said that they were exhausted, and they told me these crazy work schedules and how many jobs they were working. 2 to 3 was about the average at that dinner. And then, yeah, I think the turning point in my reporting really came when I rode that late-night bus at 11 or midnight or something like that out just along a dark highway. And I actually got stuck at one of the stops waiting for a bus like a J-1 student. And it was truly terrifying. Mm. I was someone who had been on the Cape for about 6 months and I am American. And it was still very, very scary mm-hmm. for me. And I was like, wow, I cannot imagine being new to this country and having to stand here on the edge of this dark road at night and wait for the bus to take me home. And I thought the story is something more than just happy students coming here to learn about America.
Listen, I want to get to another piece you did before we get too far here. And this is this past December, you reported a piece on a report that the 6 science institutions in Woods Hole commissioned on the state of diversity in their collective science community. Tell us a little about the report itself, who did it and what it said.
Yeah, this report was written by a Harvard sociologist. His name is Robert Livingston, and he was commissioned by the institutions to look at the state of diversity within the Woods Hole community and compile this report. It came out in March of 2018, which is a little while back, and he spoke with a number of people of color who worked at the science institutions. They were all anonymous, but he did compile a list of suggestions on how they should improve, and he also listed their stories there and their very honest accounting of what types of incidents of racism they'd encountered in Woods Hole. And it's not a good report.
Not a good report.
Very, very harsh. It's brutally honest in a lot of ways because he just put those interview transcripts of people of color into the report. And he gave some context to it. Is this normal for a community? And the answer essentially is no. The Woods Hole science community is much more insular and much less diverse than science communities in other places in a lot of ways.
One of the things that journalism can do is bring issues to light. And this was really an opportunity to do that. This was a report that kind of came out and wasn't publicized, I'm sure, because it was commissioned by the institutions, and it really pointed to some issues that they needed to tackle. They're attempting to tackle these issues. They've been doing it for, I don't know, they've had diversity programs in place for quite some time, and this was kind of indicating that they needed to step up the game or really rethink how these programs were working.
Yeah, I was really proud that the story finally came to fruition. It's something that a colleague had sent this to me around the time that I had first arrived at the station, and I had essentially been trying to report on it ever since. And it's just such a hard story to get to in a lot of ways. It's hard to get people to talk about race in general. It's hard to get people of color to talk about incidents of racism they've faced, especially when they are not necessarily in positions of power. A lot of people that I initially spoke with were not very trusting of me, and they also were afraid of losing their jobs. But I feel that there was kind of a turning point when I met Anjali Scott Price, who is one of the central characters in the story. I met her at an independent diversity event that I'd gone to on my own as a personal kind of commitment to looking into diversity in the community. I spoke with her there. I expressed my passion and interest in being able to tell stories about people of color and about their experiences with race in this community. And I think that really allowed her to open up to me, trust me, and feel like I was telling the right story. And she helped out.
Well, I think when the report came out, it was a big shock to a lot of people, and then also a kind of, seriously, people didn't know that, to a lot of other people. And I think it's really important that we have it because it actually brings a lot of things to light and things that were just like whispers in the hallway or just things that people dismissed is now actually on paper.
That is Angie Scott Price, one of the voices featured in that story on the Woods Hole Diversity Report. Sarah, you've done so much great reporting here. You've really set a high standard. We wish you the best of luck going forward.
Oh, thanks so much. It's been so nice to be able to talk about some of the highlights. And I'm going to miss being here, of course. So thank you so much.
You are listening to The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with WCAI environmental reporter Eve Zukoff. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point. I'm Steve Junker. Today, it's our reporter's notebook. We're talking about covering news and issues across the Cape, the South Coast, and the islands. We'd like you to join the conversation. Do you have a question about news coverage, a favorite story you've heard, a suggestion for something you think we should be covering? Join us on air. Give us a call, 866-999-4626, or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. And now we welcome to the program WCAI's environmental reporter, Eve Zukoff. Hi, Eve.
Good morning, Steve.
Eve, we're so glad you're here. It's an opportunity to talk about a two-part report you did that we aired last week. It examines electric cars and how they might fit into the Cape region. Now, your beat is the human impacts of climate change. Mm. So just at the beginning, explain, how do electric cars fit into the story of climate change?
Yeah, well, there are so many, you know, there are so many things that we talk about here at the station and here on air about reducing our carbon footprint, because really that's what climate change is about. We have such an enormous carbon footprint, which is really that's what's driving climate change. And in Massachusetts, 40% of our carbon footprint comes from the transportation sector. And so much of that is cars. It's individuals with their gas-powered cars. And, you know, especially here on the Cape and Islands, we really need them to get around. Mm-hmm. So many people really rely on them. But electric cars and zero-emission vehicles in particular are this really interesting alternative that you don't have to sacrifice owning an individual vehicle, but you can own something that really significantly reduces your carbon footprint because you're relying on electricity to power your car instead of gas.
And if that electricity is coming from a renewable resource,
oh my gosh, all the better.
Then you're completely taking a car out of the carbon cycle there. So here's a way to examine some positives. Electric vehicles with this tremendous potential to reduce carbon emissions, and they are moving closer and closer into reach for many people. But there's still, I think, for most of us, an unknown object. Like an electric vehicle, I see them on the street. I don't own one. I think about, I don't know what it means to own one in the Cape region. Can I charge it enough places? A number of the folks that you talked to suggested that the Cape region is actually a perfect fit for electric vehicles. Explain that for us.
Yeah, that was the really interesting thing about this story. When we came into it, you know that we were just thinking it was going to be kind of a simple story, kind of looking at, like, what is the Cape? What is the environment here in terms of our preparedness for electric vehicles? And we heard this word perfect from a number of people, and that really interested me. And part of that has to do with the distance from one end of the Cape to the other. We're based here in Woods Hole. You know, to get to Provincetown from Woods Hole, it's around 173 miles.
Round trip. Round trip, exactly.
An electric vehicle, most electric vehicles, your range is about 150 to 200 miles. So you could get from here in Woods Hole to Provincetown and back. You could get from here in Woods Hole to Boston and back. That's 155 miles. And range anxiety is one of these kind of big concerns that people have. That's this term of, will there be enough chargers? Because we know where gas stations are. We're used to seeing gas stations. But before I take the plunge of buying an electric car, am I going to be stranded somewhere? In a region that's pretty self-contained, especially on the islands where you're really looking at a self-contained, even smaller region, you don't need to have that range anxiety. Another big reason that we heard this word perfect is homeownership here. People have their own homes. They have, you know, with so many people owning their own homes, so many people own their own driveways. Mm-hmm. They don't rely on street parking, which means they can plug right into their house overnight every single night and not need to worry about charging.
One of the things as we were doing this story that you and I were talking about is that if you have an electric vehicle, your home is like your gas station.
That's exactly
every time
right.
You come back to home, you just plug it in and you're filling your car back up again, which is a different way to think about this for me as somebody who doesn't own an electric vehicle. And then I think, oh, well, that makes sense. It's almost like the way we keep our phones charged all the time. You're applying that to your vehicle now.
That's exactly right. It's a paradigm shift. You just kind of have to wrap your head around, oh, okay, this is the new way that I'm doing this. And I think for a lot of people, what I heard is that for a lot of people, it takes some understanding of, I need to think of this as plugging my phone in. And when your phone gets down to 20%, you charge up. You know, it's not like, I know many of us with our cars, we wait till we get down to 10 miles or so before we fill up.
And then look for a gas station.
Desperately. Yes. But no, you don't do that with an electric vehicle quite as much.
There's one more reason why the Cape is a perfect fit, and it has to do with demographics.
That's exactly right. We really came to understand the demographics of the Cape as being really a key piece of why there might be an even bigger market here on the Cape, and we have a little bit of that. Compared to the national average, the Cape's demographics skew wealthier and older, and maybe less demanding in their travel needs.
The soccer mom is probably not going to be looking for an electric vehicle because most of the electric vehicles are small.
On the whole, retirees fortunate enough to have the means, time, and flexibility are prime candidates for electric vehicle ownership. David Issa says he sees these kinds of customers in Hyannis a lot, and they've typically already made a decision about what they want before stepping foot in a dealership.
For them, it's not a choice of, do I want an electric or a gas? It's a choice of, am I going to get the regular plug-in or am I going to get the DC high-speed fast charge?
So if it sounds to you like it did to me, that there's a promising setup for electric vehicles or EVs, the answer to my next question may come as a surprise. Is the Cape, infrastructurally, culturally, is it ready for an EV explosion?
No.
So is the Cape ready for all of those electric vehicles today? Probably not.
Is the Cape ready? I'd say the Cape is as ready as any place else. And I don't think we're leading the way.
That is a clip from Eve Zuckoff's two-part report on electric vehicles and the Cape. Eve, a lot of hesitation and ambivalence about our readiness there. So tell us, if the Cape region is supposedly such a great fit for electric vehicles, why aren't we ready and what do we have to do to get there?
Yeah, there are a number of things. And that was the question that we actually asked that to everyone we interviewed. And they all gave that uniform answer, which is where we said, oh, this is a two-part series. There's part one of why the Cape is perfect, and there's a lot of good reasons. And then there's part two. And part two, we really focused on, you know, first of all, the price needs to come down for a lot of people. That's first and foremost. But really, number two, the unique thing for the Cape is that we really need to figure out how to make way for charging stations, because we can't just expect the number of people who are here, say, right now in January. That number will quadruple in July. And we have to be ready for how many more, specifically tourists, visitors, are going to need to plug in. There are going to be so many more demands. And businesses are definitely stepping in. They're seeing, oh, not only can we do something that feels good, like encouraging electric vehicle ownership, we can attract new customers. We can retain the same customers if we add, you know, the added benefit of having a charging station in our parking lot. But towns really need to step in, too, and they need to recognize that they can share a similar benefit of bringing more tourists to their town. But they really, even if they don't see that, they need to recognize that the state itself has goals about getting more electric and zero emission vehicles on the roads. And we need to answer the demand to be ready for that.
Well, really, the Cape region, as we all know, is unique, and it has these challenges because for much of the year, as now, it's the population is a lot less than it will be for those 2 months in the summer or those 10 weeks in the summer. And when people come here, you were saying that people with an electric vehicle, they typically charge at home or maybe they charge at work. I think your story said 90% of people do all their charging at home or at work.
That's right.
But people coming on vacation, obviously they're not at home and they're coming here to get away from work. So they're out of their routine charging schedule. So you can understand why We have to rethink how we're going to provide charging for people here in a way that another community that is not a tourist-based economy won't have to think about.
That's right. And you know, even so we talked to Stephen Tupper, manager of transportation with the Cape Cod Commission, and he noted that, you know, around the Cape, there are probably like 17 community activity centers. Those are like really popular downtown areas. Think Commercial Street in Provincetown, downtown Chatham. If there are 17 of them, only half have electric chargers. That's a problem. We really need to figure out that that's where people are going to be spending the day. That's where they're going to do their activities here on the Cape, because, you know, they might be staying in a house, a rental, a motel while they're here. They might be here for 2 days. They might be here for a week. There are really different kinds of visitors who come. And really the place we should be meeting their demands is where they're doing things. And we know people come here for the shops downtown, for the beaches, of course, for some of our wonderful museums. That's where these charging stations should mm-hmm. be.
I want to talk to you a little bit about your reporting generally. Mm-hmm. You're covering climate change across the region. I think a lot of people must wonder, you know, what does that mean really? Or maybe they think that it means that you cover just one kind of story. But really, it turns out you've been here since the middle of the year, June. It turns out that covering climate change means you cover lots of different kinds of stories.
That's right. That's been the true joy of covering this beat. I have covered transportation, health, education, breaking news, like the tornadoes, as you might remember. Mm-hmm. I cover arts and culture. So, you know, over the last 6 months, we've covered the Falmouth Road Race, thinking of it from a climate change perspective. It's an institution that people love, and it's run in the middle of the August heat. You know, we just had a weekend here that reached into the 70s. You know, as we watch global temperatures rise, what is our middle of August going to look like? Mm-hmm. So that was a chance to do it. We did a climate change musical. We have done wildlife, stories about whales, turtles, scallops. We've done stories about housing, looking at Surf Drive in Falmouth, really, you know, how the town is going to adjust to sea level rise in a road that's regularly flooded and covered in houses. And transportation. These electric vehicle stories are a great example. And we've also covered the bridges, really thinking about the Cape Cod Canal bridges from a climate change point of view.
All right. So let me ask you this. Climate change is this global issue. It's so high level. And, the whole way the process happens and the impacts and how we deal with it. So why is it important to talk about climate change locally?
Oh, man. Okay. Well, climate change... So a particle of carbon that's released anywhere in the world has the same effect. You know, it doesn't matter if a particle of carbon is released in China. We are going to experience the same levels of sea level rise. So everywhere across the country, everywhere across the world needs to be thinking about their carbon emissions. And the thing is, in a place like the Cape, where most places are surrounded on at least one side by water, sea level rise is an existential threat that is facing the Cape. And we're watching sea level rise predictions really accelerate. And we're watching scientists say, oh, we underestimated how fast sea levels are rising. And with sea level rise, we will see changes in what streets are underwater. We will see chronic flooding. We'll see homes underwater. We'll also see more massive storms because of climate change. And again, as a place that's low-lying, that's sitting on a sandy rocks, essentially, we need to be thinking about the ways that our changing oceans, that are changing weather, that are changing climate is going to affect our entire way of life.
What kinds of feedback do you get from the community when you're out and around and you identify yourself as the environmental reporter, the climate change reporter?
I get a lot of excitement and also a lot of really personal stories. Mm. I mean, people, we talk about keeping a special place special, and that's what the Cape is to people who live here, to people who visit here, people who say, I went to the Cape, you know, for my whole childhood. I went down to Sandwich. I haven't been back in 20 years, but don't change that road. You know, like people really, really care about the environment. They know that it's integral to what makes this place special. And they want to talk to me. And I love getting people who say to me, you know, I'm really concerned about erosion in this part of my community. I'm really concerned about bats in this part of my mm-hmm. community. I mean, there are so many ways that rising temperatures, that rising seas, that more acidic seas affect our ways of life. And people tell me that. They're not shy about that. And especially the younger generation is really not shy. And I know Sarah's terrific reporter was talking about how wonderful it is that teenagers are excited to have microphones in their face. And I have that too.
And just briefly, how much do you feel it is a young person's issue these days?
It can't be just a young person's issue. It has to be everyone's issue. The fervor is really with teenagers. You know, they really are thinking about it critically. They also are thinking about it deeply as teenagers. So, you know, there are some things that they talk about in ways that I'm excited to see how they mature and how they process some of those same ideas as they get older. But they feel excited and they do feel ownership. They feel like we are the ones. They feel angry that they are the ones who have been left with so many problems facing their generation, but they seem game to really tackle climate change in the next, you know, decades to come.
Eve Zuckoff, thank you for coming in. Eve Zuckoff, our environmental reporter here at WCAI.
My pleasure. Thank you, Steve.
That is our show for today, our first Reporter's Notebook. We're hoping to do this periodically, checking in with our reporters on what they're working on, and asking you, the listener, to call and talk about the local news that matters to you. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.